So we haven't spoken unless I've forgotten, but I don't forget faces very quickly. So why don't you tell me a little bit about yourself?
Sure. And you're correct. So first time speaking. My name's Joseph, based in Southern California. San Pedro, this is the town. It's in part of LA County. So right above Long Beach.
Oh, okay.
Born and raised here. 28 years old. Spent all my time here. Both of my folks are also from the area. Grandparents on my mother's side were Sicilians, and grandfolks on my father's side, Puerto Rican and Mexican backgrounds, which is pretty common for the area. Pedro, pronounced Pedro as opposed to San Pedro, the way that you could tell the townies from the out-of-towners.
Yep.
So Pedro's got plenty of Croatian, Italian immigrant families here. A lot of them have deep roots, and then there's always been a Mexican-American, you know, contingent in the area. So a heavily Catholic, plenty of churches, a lot of kind of that, not traditionalist, but family-oriented type of environment, especially in the local elementary schools and preschools and whatnot. And since the population of the town's not too big, there's a lot of folks know each other, and you're bound to run into someone you know at the store or the gym around town. So somewhat of a, not quite a small town, but distanced enough from Los Angeles and from Long Beach that you get the sense that it's kind of in a realm in between. My father always kind of spoke of it as Pedro's the place where you want to live so that you can visit Los Angeles and not have to spend the night there. So we're stone's throw from a few different areas and you know, socioeconomic realms, and it's nice to get a good mix of that down here, not have to, you know, deal with traffic in LA or coming over the bridge to Long Beach. So, but as far as a bit about me, I guess that might be relevant. History major, educated at UCLA, finished in 2013. My first 2 years schooling I had spent at UC Santa Cruz. Coming out of UCLA, I had the opportunity to either carry on with the education to the master's, and I'd hoped to become a professor or a teacher in some capacity. But by the time I finished school, I had so much student debt that it didn't seem feasible for me to want to go, you know, forward. My folks had always encouraged it, and they never shied away from going the extra mile as far as my schooling was concerned or that of my younger brother. You know, when they were both working crazy hours to put my brother and I through local private Catholic school and then private high schools, we actually ended up driving out to LA. I went to Loyola High School out on Venice Boulevard out there. So it was a Jesuit run institution and almost looked like a mini college. And in some ways, being a high school student in that environment as a prep school was more difficult than my actual college years.
Yeah.
So which
yeah.
was the point, I suppose.
Yep. Yep.
So it paved the way on that end. So when I finally finished up at UCLA, you know, I had to make some decisions, and it seemed more viable to me to try to find my way into the workforce. My father had worked for Hughes and then became Boeing for several, 27 years, I believe, total before he retired. And they were going through a periodic hiring and layoff waves. And at the time, the Boeing site out in El Segundo, as a satellite production facility out there, was undergoing one of the hiring waves. So I, you know, threw my hat in the ring and managed to get an entry-level position working as a liaison between floor-level production manufacturing and then some of the functional and operational managers there. So a far cry from anything academic, and a far cry from anything that I had familiarity with. Had to learn how to read, you know, production blueprints, drawings, and learned about spacecraft integration and satellite systems, and the ground support equipment was what I was primarily responsible for coordinating. So to be plucked from my academic environment and put into a manufacturing environment without the skill sets that I, you know, that you presumably would need, was quite a trial by fire. And, fortunately, between my father still being on the site for the last 2 or 3 years, I actually got to give him work orders at the site, which was nice. But then got to learn from him and his crew and other folks there who had, you know, been there longer term. Was a pretty much a big eye-opening experience for me about just how far removed my academic world was, both in terms of the relevance of what I was learning, you know, for my day-to-day life, but also the way in which it did or did not kind of function as a character cultivation site for myself or for some of my colleagues. There was, and I've been out of the university for, you know, for several years now, 5 or 6 years. And I don't, other than what perhaps in you as well, you know, may see or hear about echo chambers and universities and things of that nature. I've met some folks younger than me who have come through that, and they certainly seem to reflect parts of that in their dispositions. But being in the environment surrounded by engineers, project managers, you know, folks who were sometimes it seemed living to work rather than working to live, kind of put me in a spot where I had to reassess what I wanted out of my work life, how I could apply anything that I had learned as a history student to my understanding of not so much the work that I was doing, but the interplay between folks of different backgrounds that I was meeting at work, often folks who were 2 or 3 generations, you know, older than I was. And on the manufacturing side and the floor level production areas, folks who didn't have degrees, some of them only had high school diplomas, my father being an example, and folks just who in general were not entirely concerned with the scale or development of current events or politics or things that appeared, you know, to me and my colleagues at school to be all consuming. And, you know, kind of, well, how do you get through life if you don't know what's going on overseas or, you know, what the latest, you know, political intrigue is? And so it was a very trying but a very rewarding experience to transition to that environment. And once I spent some time there, and I'm still employed in aerospace and still in satellite production, which I know is very, even within aerospace, is a unique facet of corporate operations, and you know, you have different types of folks who work on the air side and folks who work on the space side and tend to run into some different personalities, even though the functions can be somewhat similar. It was a very, it's been a very rewarding experience. It's something that continues to kind of speak to me as a character, a larger character building enterprise that I'm involved with, just beyond something that pays the bills or gives me a means to live. And so what drew me into, I guess that's a segue, and part, feel free to, you know, interrupt if I'm
I'll keep going. You're doing great.
So part of what brings me over to you and to the wider community of discourse that's going on YouTube is when I had come out of school, and especially during my early years, as a history major with an emphasis on Western European history, we took the full, just meaning in general, me and my colleagues, had full kind of unfettered views of the ups and downs of religious practice and the Catholic Church. I had a particular interest in medieval history and the Reformation and Renaissance periods. And so to see, you know, Catholic institutions as a state at the time, more so than the kind of the monastic enterprises that they had running on the side that were involved with the theology of things, to see the church's evolution over the course of Reformation, Counter-Reformation, Renaissance, and then on to the current times, it was almost an assumption among folks that I was growing up with that religion was, or Catholicism, or Christianity in particular, was kind of this, essentially a non-starter. You could go into a room and at any kind of gathering or hang around after class and ask who was a believer, who was religious and who wasn't, and it guaranteed you would get maybe 1 or 2 hands raised if that, you know, if folks were even willing to identify. Yeah. Right. And as it was something that would be hidden. When I was at UC Santa Cruz for my freshman and sophomore years, it was even perhaps more secularized and more, irreligious, not even secular, but more so somewhat latent hostility among students I was with up there. A lot of left-leaning students, self-identified communists or self-identified socialists and things of that nature. And so in that environment, the way that I saw students interacting with themselves and with their teachers and the way that they were conducting themselves began to rub me the wrong way. And I got the sense that discourse there was going to be limited with the people around me. Now, mind you, I never had any issues with staff, professors of any institution that I was a part of. And so I attribute maybe some of that stubbornness on the part of just, us all being young and trying to navigate a world that seemed to be easily definable according to what we were learning. And in practice, once you stepped outside of those definitions, was a lot more nuanced and harder to confront. But eventually I moved away from Santa Cruz. That's when I transferred to UCLA in my junior, senior years to finish my undergrad degree. And in those environments, I kind of doubled down on my emphasis on Western European history. My capstone course was actually one of those discussion type courses with our professor about the Stalinist purges in the 1950s. And kind of the very interesting cycle of secret police organizations and police heads or internal security chiefs that would rise and fall according to the whims of whatever party leader had, paved their way into that position. And a lot of the, just how fragile everything was even in those environments for folks who appeared to have plenty of power, but were only a word or a look or an act or a handshake away or, an omission away from losing it all. And that discussion course put me into a training mode for debate with other students. We had to defend some of the more heinous acts that those police chiefs may have ordered. Hmm. And then we also had to defend them and argue against them. And so that was an interesting environment as well to see how folks were bringing their ideas into play. The reason I bring all of this up was essentially that coming out of university, the net result of what I had outside of massive student debt was the folks I had grown up with folks I'd gone to school with, at least, who had similar educational backgrounds to me, who had been, somewhat socioeconomically leveled by virtue of having their degrees and having gone through a nominally cosmopolitan exposure to different peoples and places, and had been in environments that had encouraged free exchange of thought and understanding and all the other things that come along with a contemporary liberal arts education. I struggled to see how their, and for myself too, how that type of awareness or exposure could translate down into the day-to-day operations of our lives and interactions with the people around us outside of the classroom and outside of the institution. During my years in college, I'd become a pretty strident materialist, and I didn't, not only was I non-religious, I was more characterized as irreligious, if not anti-religious. And you get that kind of closeted elitism that comes with being around people who agree with you all the time. I would come home to my folks and people down here in town or go to family gatherings and things like that and get exposed to what you've called the common religion, and which only seemed to vindicate everything that I had felt was true. So there's nothing unique about that story. It's probably true. I know it's true for plenty of folks. And especially in being surrounded, being a part of an Italian family or a Mexican-American family where you've got Catholicism wrapped up with your identity beyond a religious practice.
Oh yeah.
That just becomes a big grounds for familial spats and things like that. Right.
Yeah.
It doesn't really become a source of dialogue. There's only one right answer, and only one answer is going to be accepted. So plenty of sparring with my family members, and plenty of sparring with my parents. And once I got into the end of the workforce and started to see things a little bit more detail as far as how folks were actually acting, regardless of what may or may not have come out of their mouths or how they identified themselves. Began to change, you know, slowly my opinions of it, or not my opinions of it, but my posture with it, my stance, you know, towards that. And when I was finally turned on to 12 Rules by Peterson and went through that, actually had the opportunity. I saw him speak in Long Beach on one of the tours. The bulk of that was devoted to his free exchange of ideas and free speech. And so it wasn't totally pertaining to any kind of Christian thought, but was still fruitful. And I found Peterson to be a positive influence for myself as far as jump-starting a process of introspection that eventually pulled me up. It didn't pull me, but I drew me away from delving into Peterson or perhaps delving into any of the other contemporary thinkers that are associated or in proximity to him, and actually pitched me back towards my roots as a history student. And to take Peterson's message about accountability, about introspection, about self-awareness and continuous self-improvement, and then try to pull that back to what I've been interested in as far as the Reformation was concerned, Luther and Calvin and Zwingli, that was what actually began a whole train of thought for me about things that I had appreciated as a student, but I hadn't had the willingness to take a leap of not so much a leap of faith, but a leap of inquiry into that on a deeper level for myself. At the time, you know, in parallel to all of that, I was and still am a pretty big heavy metal fan. So I've got, you know, was going to concerts, and you know, I used to have my goatee all grown out pretty large. In fact, my whole body's covered, both arms, sleeves, chest covered, tattoos, you know, some of which are pretty provocative and not necessarily Christian friendly by any means. And so for me to have spent quite a bit of time, you know, and creative expenditure and contemplative expenditure of my, you know, my energies and emotions in that environment was very testing for me, because I had in my, you know, kind of in my rationalism approached Peterson as a secular guru for self-improvement. And here he was asking me to look not only at my actions, but to also look at what I surrounded myself with. And if I could get down to kind of the meat of those ideologies and what was the actual output for what I was consuming. And it began to trigger in me a very kind of gradual drift away from many of the things that I had identified with heavily over the years. I felt like it had brought me down to a point where, not brought me down, but brought me to a point where it was no longer tenable for me to listen to musics or to listen, to read articles or be exposed to media that I could simply put away as background noise. It almost over the course of a few weeks, it started to seem as if everything mattered. Everything I was in proximity to or everything I consumed, did or did not have an output on my day-to-day behaviors and understanding of the people around me, understanding of myself. And I took that very seriously. I really had to go back and begin to look at to what extent was I merely tolerating some of the extreme ideas or presentations or medias that I was involved with or had embraced. To what extent was I rationalizing or justifying some of the more violent or ephemeral things, violently, you know, kind of postured lyrics, things like that. And how could I, as someone who thought that they were a rational human being, consider that it was okay for me to be in proximity to these things purely by the grounds that I could write it off as being creative license or exploratory or some kind of, you know, that it's not real, it's just songs, or it's not real, it's just media, or it's presentation. And the more I went to shows and such, and the more I got involved with things, began to look at folks that I was around in those communities and try to parse out, well, if I'm feeling this way, have these folks gone all in and have they subsumed those ideas and attitudes in their day-to-day behavior? You know, how are they treating one another in these environments? How are they treating me? How are they treating females in these types of male-dominated environments, right, or male-driven environments? And, you know, to me now, it appears to have been almost a foregone conclusion. It was that folks were very much acting the same as perhaps they always had acted. I had was around folks who were, you know, polite as could be and very respectful and gentle people, albeit covered in offensive imagery or, you know, leather vests. And I was around folks that were, you know, appeared to have taken things to heart or perhaps had always been hard of heart and treated others disrespectfully and yeah, you know, with contempt. Huh. And I had to realize that if I found that type of behavior to be offensive, if I found the communal disrespect or any or the misogyny or the self-destructive tendencies to arise an emotional rejection within me, that it was up to me to get down to the deeper root of that response. I had already known that a certain degree of that is part of your conditioning as you're brought up, you know, in the environments that you're around and what your family structure is like and the dynamics that are there. Part of it's influenced by environments that you are exposed to in school or at play. And then maybe a third component of that are the things that we pursue independently as part of our, hopefully as part of our self-development as individuals or individuals within a larger community where we have responsibilities. And I would bring, you know, my role at work into that as well. And so drawing all that back to come back to Peterson and say, hey, you know, rhetorically, you know, this, the stuff about the room or standing up straight, you know, that's all, those are things that I can see have practical application day to day, but as a you know, as a self-identified atheist or irreligious person, I need to get down into those deeper layers to figure out why I feel the way I do about particular actions or activities and how I can get my own emotional sphere kind of in check and really make sure that I'm trying to align how I act with what I consume and how I act with what I, you know, say I believe in at least, and how I act with what I believe in, or claim I believe in internally, things that aren't vocalized, right? And as branching off of Peterson exposed me to your channel and to some of the larger dialogues that have been going on there. And I'd say that one of the immediate take homes I had from, and I'm not particularly, you know, I haven't been in school for some time and I don't have the same kind of command of concepts that guests on your channel have. Sometimes stuff goes way over my head and, I try to bring it back down into the realm where I can grasp it. And that's okay because everyone's doing that to some extent.
So that's exactly right.
You know, but to see that your ability to speak with folks of different backgrounds, to collate that information, to try to parse out further points for dialogue or further points for disagreement, respectful disagreement, which is huge, further points for refinement. You know, that to me was one of the most, I would say, I think the first word that comes to mind is enlightening, but the real word that I want to use when I hold my rational self back on that is that it's heartwarming. And it triggers an emotional response in me that I'm very grateful for, and I'm very happy, for lack of a better term, just to see is present, right?
Yeah.
And to see folks of all shapes and sizes engaging with one another, even if it is visually, because I know in person it's going to be the same. To see folks engage with one another like that is very reassuring and very, it's brought about in me, I think, a willingness and a drive to sit and listen and to hold some of my maybe more characteristic failings, which would be probably an impetus to judgment or an impetus to anger, to hold those things in check. And for that, thank you and thank all the folks on your channel too for bringing that to someone like myself. or to anyone who perhaps has felt the same way. It's a very tangible and tangible and beautiful thing that has come out of the internet realm, which is also often filled with so much negativity for folks. But hopefully that gives you enough background to...
Yeah, that's wonderful. I love your story. It's such a cool... So, I grew up in New Jersey, and, where I grew up, large Italian population. And so I can very much... And Italian, blue collar, and then some go off to college. And so I can very much resonate with your story your story has so many interesting elements. You've got such an interesting life. And so congratulations. Where are you at now in terms of your belief? Do you go to church at all? How's that going with your parents in terms of where you're at? What's that look like now?
So the, in my current state, one of the traits I've tried to reinforce within myself as I reopen all these doors I had previously shut, right, is a strong sense of prudence and caution. And I say that not so much as that there are things in there that are there to hurt me or damage me, but more so in the sense that there is so much, not only is there so much at stake, from a purely, and I don't mean stake as in, damnation or souls, but there's so much at stake as far as how I can align myself to better understand myself and the people around me towards a higher conviction moving forward, that I'm really trying to take my time with how I go about it. And I think the other thing that would draw from my experience is that, once again, going back to the roots as a history student, I've been somewhat dancing around the different realms that pertain to perhaps what I find most interesting would be applied Christianity, right? Or applied practice of belief. It's one thing for me to listen to YouTube videos or yourself in conversations with larger concepts. And I'm not entirely hip to all of the jokes about things being meta and stuff like that, that's a whole separate subculture of dialogue that's going on. But more primarily for me of importance is how can I interplay with that realm to a way where I have an understanding of some of the larger concepts that are not tangibles. And then how do I bring myself into proximity with Christian communities or Christian practice? I suppose I should back up and say that obviously I've made some decisions to align myself back towards a Christian orientation. And I guess the trigger for that or the basis for that would be that as a history student, I've yet to see a more beautiful tale, or a more beautiful myth in the sense that I think you'll understand how I intend that, than the story of Jesus.
Yeah.
And I've yet to see a more impactful myth or event on the trajectory of the human species and the human organism as a communal entity than Christianity.
Yeah.
And although I know that there's been plenty of open hand and closed fist realms to that impact, and that I don't try to hide any of that, that's something I can't escape. To see the ability of Christianity as an experiential process of transcendence for folks who've managed to cross the line from our human nature and into something a bit better.
Yeah.
And to see the transformative effects that it has on people of all tongues and shapes and sizes over the course of human history.
Yeah.
And to also see the impact that it's had in formatting an environment in contemporary America where I can express these opinions and we all have this kind of, most of us who don't spend too much time sitting in front of computers debating on things have this moral compass that can generally be agreed or expected upon in day-to-day interactions with strangers,
yeah.
Regardless of what their beliefs are, yeah. That's something that to me that is a, it's almost like it's like a living artifact of it's like a, not an artifact, but it's a living light that kind of continues to pull me in that direction. And I can't ignore it. I can't rationalize it away. The attempts to kind of pick it apart from a, you know, some kind of, to pick apart metaphysics or something like that and try to treat it, you know, to approach it with my old materialist disposition is no longer something that, that seems valid to me. Yeah. Because after all these years of doing that, I now see how much beauty I was missing out on and shielding myself from rather than opening myself to, because of this misalignment that I feel I have with, not only who I was, but perhaps where I was in society and what my community meant to me and what I meant to them.
Yeah.
So to go back to your question, I've been dancing around these facets, both on the kind of like the metaphysics side and then also with returning to the study of the Reformation, the different types of dynamism that have covered Protestant thought in both Europe and in America over, you know, since Luther. That's been the playground that I've been in, you know, as of late, trying to read and understand a bit more, and to see where my applied and emotional responses to Christian behavior, maybe perhaps not belief, but I can't say that I go out into the world and I don't try to meet some, if not all, as best I can, of those, you know, expectations of Christian behavior, trying to see where I gravitate towards in that realm.
Yeah.
And I have enough familiarity with Luther and Calvin, to understand some of the differences in their, not only in their theology, but also as far as what that translates to in the day-to-day practice or did translate to in the day-to-day practice for folks back at that time and now in the current time.
Yeah.
I think, and you would know more on this than I would for sure, because of how intertwined communities are now, and because Christian practice, I think, in the U.S. has somewhat, at least in my experience, that's all I can speak for here, is that it has largely transcended denominational boundaries into kind of this very easily consumed oatmeal of Christians, you know, practice, you know, and obviously that works for plenty of people because they're participants in it, but and it bleeds over into that kind of like ethno communal identity type of Christianity. But whereas I'm not so much interested in all of the distinctions of theology between the different denominations, I am interested in how particular personality types or dispositions may feel a pull towards particular denominations. You know, why do some people become born again? Why do some folks make choices to return to Catholicism, which is, I know, has been on the rise as of late, with some high profile, you know, returns to Catholicism, or they would call it a return to Catholicism. But, you know, so that's, for me, that's where I'm kind of trying to tease out both the historic differences, the contemporary differences, and then what I feel in my personal experience and how my relationship with the transcendent that I'm involved with, at what point could I begin to call myself a Christian, right? At what point do I begin to use that term as an identifier?
Yeah.
I know plenty of folks will hold for, or hope at least for, conversion experiences and dramatic, you know, impacts to that end. But, you know, the more behavioral transformations I've undergone over the past few months, none of which were associated with any type of prayer. I haven't been inside of a church since probably my high school days. I haven't, you know, I don't read the Bible regularly. Most of my exposure to Christian thought and practice is either via the internet and some of these dialogues that go on, or the books that I go out on my own to read, often which are written by theologians or other kind of religiously inclined academics. you know, how do you bridge that gap when you come from an environment, or when you came from an environment that was so bound on having all your ducks in a row before you make the next step? And not everyone comes from those environments. And so folks are very emotionally driven and impulsive, you know, for better or for worse with their, with their forays into faith. So, that's where I currently am. I have a strong interest in Calvinism. I have a strong interest in Methodism, both of, and that's kind of, they're somewhat on different ends of the spectrum, right? So it's me trying to determine what parts of me are those practices, or is that community speaking to, and then what parts of me are at the core of my experience, and what parts have I layered on over the years? Mm-hmm. What parts are aesthetic? What parts are, they're all genuine, but certainly it's differentiating between these layers of clothing that I've put on and what the actual skin is. And after you spend so much time kind of in a morass of that big Christian oatmeal, you really don't know how it's kind of tough to go back there and really try to figure out. I'm sure it takes, I know it takes years, and sometimes it takes a lifetime for folks. So hence my prudence on that. But, you know, talking to people and just, you know, as I mentioned earlier, just sitting down and listening externally and internally is kind of my current approach to that. I don't know what you think of that, if you've had similar experiences with folks. And
well, you're obviously a very reflective guy. And you think things through, and you think things through deeply, and you've got, you know enough to know how much you don't know, which is a really important thing. And, you know, it's been so interesting watching this journey through for so many people, where so many people who grew up evangelical, you know, they go into a Roman Catholic or an Orthodox church and they're like, wow, so much here. Right. So many people who grew up Orthodox and Roman Catholic go into the church they grew up in, and they're like, oh, I can just feel it on me. I need something else. And so there's a lot of, and I love your phrase, the oatmeal of Christian practice. Oatmeal is just such a good image for this. The American religious melting pot made oatmeal, and oatmeal on one hand can be sort of bland and colorless and just a mixture of everything, but also so nutritious and good for you. And so what a wonderful image. Well, and you know well that, this is one of the things I learned from Peterson very well, which is that, you know, in an action, there's so much potential of this. I mean, I'll say it better. Hundreds of years of tradition and lives get distilled down into tiny actions. And that's where actions themselves are so potent and so real sometimes, when thoughts are so abstract and just floating out there. So I love your story, and I mean, it very much resonates me in terms of, you've both got an academic desire and an academic inclination, where you're reflective and you're making things work in the abstract, but you've also got in your life the practical of, you know, you're not just thinking, you're not just doing the abstract engineering of satellites, but you're in the manufacturing, because manufacturing is incarnational. You take the ideas of engineers and you put them through manufacturing engineers, and you make stuff that works. And there's something very, and so I love the sense of your story, where you've both got the heaven in terms of the abstract and the thinking and the thought, and you've still got an appreciation for the concrete and the tactile, and that's in your body. I had a good friend of mine who passed away last year in this church, and he was completely tatted up. And the funny thing about tattoos is that they are They are records of moments of your life that are placed indelibly in your skin. And so my friend too, he had, so he would come into church with people. He was the only one in church with just was full of tattoos, and people would look at him and he'd just say, "My insides don't match my outsides." And because he'd say, you know, it, and Brandon, especially, I'm talking about my friend Brandon, he had so many different permutations in his life. He had such an interesting yet tortured yet amazing life. You're so articulate, and you've got such, you know, I really like how you very systematically laid so much of yourself out there in this way. How old are you now?
28.
Oh, you've got a lot of, yeah. you're going to keep going, and you've already done a lot in 28 years. And I love how your story is. You know, so I grew up in Paterson, which is outside New York, and in the New York metropolitan area is even more ghettoized than Los Angeles, which has a degree of it where, you know, you're part of a town, but this town is in the midst of this huge metropolitan area, yet everyone, town is not just geography, it's these interrelations and connections, and how you said, you know somebody's from here when they say Pedro, not Pedro, right. And so I connect with that on so many different levels. And I think you're only 28. I think you're going to, you're just starting out in this journey. And I'm glad that you haven't wasted too much of your life in, I'm glad, let me say it this way. I'm glad that you're reconnecting with so many of the deeper things and your history education and your education at Loyola. I mean, how many of these high schools, how many of these Jesuit high schools named Loyola aren't there all around the United States that are exactly what you described? Mm-hmm. And so I'm just fascinated by your story and how, you know, oh, then you bump into Jordan Peterson, and I can really see how Peterson for you would start tying things together and force you to say, hey, what am I doing with my time? What am I doing with these things that I'm putting into my mind? Where do I really want to go with this? And what are these things connected to? So, and so now kind of, you know, you're turning back and saying, okay, let's think again about this Christianity business. I mean, it's so, you know, so like so many just kind of casually threw it away only to later realize I had very little appreciation for what was actually given to me. Yet your reaction to it, given the environment and everything going on, was completely understandable. So this has just been, you know, deeply interesting to me how you just, I think you just told your story very, very well. And I really appreciate it. I want to talk to you in 10 years and find out what these next 10 years, because you're only 28. So, you know, really in some ways you go to high school, you're still kind of this target of your parents' desires. You go to college, you went to, you know, UC Santa Cruz. I have a son going there now, and then UCLA, and there you start to change. And then, well, gosh, you've got the student debt, and you studied history. You know, who studies history if they want to get rich? You know, nobody.
Right. Absolutely.
And then you wind up in a manufacturing type job, and, you know, the heavy metal, and then Peterson. It's just awesome story.
I'm glad that there are things there that resonate with you. That's,
oh yeah,
and that makes me happy to hear that.
Yeah, and you're doing the work. You know, you're doing exactly what you need to be doing. And I just want to encourage you and say, you know, keep at it and keep, you know, and then, you know, I remember when I was in I went to Calvin College, and then I went to Calvin Seminary, and I'd started Calvin Seminary. And to go into the seminary, they make you do all these psychological things because they want to make sure that, you know, you're not going to be a pastor who's also an axe murderer that tends to look bad in the church.
Right.
So, um, So you do, we do all these battery of psychological testing, and you talk to a shrink and all this stuff. And so I had done all my testing, and I had my, you know, my hour with the shrink when he's, you know, looked at all my testing, and the shrink, I don't know who he is. I can't remember his face. I remember one thing he said to me that at the time was exactly what I needed to hear. Maybe he said it to everybody. It was, I needed to hear at that point, right. But he said to me, he said, you know, what you need to do is you need to make a commitment and stick with it. And I had at that point just, I'd been going out for a while with the woman who was now my wife, and I broke up with her, and which she still hasn't forgiven me for, but 31 years of marriage later, she still hasn't forgiven me for it. But, and I remember that the psychologist saying, you know, you need to learn the power of commitment, because, and at the same time, Lou Smeads, who was a guiding light in the Christian Reformed Church, who had taught at Calvin College and then went to teach at Fuller in Pasadena for a number of years. He was back at Calvin doing a lecture on commitment, on the power of commitment, talking about how, you know, how commitments are, there's these distinctly human decisions that we make that launch a life. And I remember sitting with the shrink, and the shrink was saying, you know, looking at my life, and he's like, you know, you need to, I was at that point unmarried, not yet engaged. He says, you know, you need to make a commitment. And I was, you know, it's like, cause it's so, this life that in our culture, we think is the optimal life, which is someone who has as many options open as possible, mm-hmm. in as many areas as possible.
Right.
And basically the wisdom of commitment is exactly the reverse, where it says you need to narrow your options. And in many ways, your story is about, you know, cause yeah, Mexican, Italian, you don't get much more Catholic than that.
Yeah,
and I mean, right. It's just boom, locked in, and yep. Family tradition, all that stuff. And then you go out to university, and it's like, wide open spaces, be whatever you want, do whatever you want. And then you begin to realize there's a reason we don't live on the Serengeti. There's a reason we build these boxes and live in them. Right. And then, okay, so then the question is, what decision will I make in my 20s that I might curse in my 30s and 40s, but be especially grateful for in my 50s and 60s if I keep the commitment? And those are powerful things. So I guess my, you know, I want to encourage you, because I think you're doing great. I love your story. I think that, speaking as a pastor, I think God is working with you, and I'm really interested to see what he makes of you if I ever get to see that. But I also want to encourage you to think about the power of commitment, of saying, I'm going to commit to something. And in my case, it was a marriage and a woman that I committed to. And that, of course, you know, we've been married for 31 years now. And you know, that commitment certainly has shaped my life and brought children into the world and all of those kinds of things. But it need not be that type of commitment, but to make a commitment to something and then see how that, you know, I remember when I was a kid, I went to some thing at a class trip, and they had rock candy, and I'd never known rock candy at all. And I thought, oh, rock candy, that's amazing. And then I somehow figured out, we didn't have the internet, that you could make rock candy yourself by putting a piece of string in highly charged sugar water. And I was unsuccessful in my attempt to create rock candy at that point. But the image of the string is sort of the commitment. And it's all the stuff around that has the possibility to create something that is not necessarily of your making or choosing, but something that God will use. And there'll be days that you curse it and days that you're deeply grateful for it. But it'll be very concrete. It'll be tangible. It'll be durable. And so I don't know. This has just been, I love hearing your story. I love seeing what God has made in you, and I'm excited to see what he does with you. So it's cool.
Oh, I'm absolutely open to it. I think part of the gradual kind of not transformation, but a lot of these gradual changes. And if you had, you know, known me 2 or 3 years ago, you would never have, it would have been unimaginable that I would be having this conversation or speaking. I don't know. I'm not sure where the seed was planted, you know, or at what point there was no dramatic incident or trauma or loss, or achievement that, you know, that signaled, a gradual shedding of some of these old skins I had accumulated or outgrown perhaps.
Yeah.
But the physical and the, participatory and tangible changes in my interface with other people and in the amount of thought I'm giving to my own actions on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah.
Certainly the amount of reflection I now assign to the things that I do, more so than I did before, has been a something that I really cannot attribute to anything on this planet. And I think that's one of the primary drivers for me to continue to navigate the different paths that are in front of me and continue to be open to further experiences and no longer write off how I felt or you know, I guess you could call it conscience, but I think it's something even a bit deeper than that. And again, I'm not sure where that spark came from. I don't get the sense that it can go away. You know, it may dim and it may turn into a flame, but there's something that perhaps was there all along. And I just needed to put myself in a position to experience it or see it. So I'm very excited for that. I look forward to all the learning that's going to come, but more so all of the changes that I think can be, that can accompany all of that.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's wonderful. We're running out of time. So any last minute questions or anything you wanted to get to that say, I wanted to talk to Paul about this, before we wrap up.
You know, so the only thing I would say, that I had in my mind was in my encounters with the concept of predestination, right. And that becomes a sticky subject for a lot of folks.
Yeah.
But I had always wondered if that aforementioned, if the aforementioned spark that I've kind of been referencing, I don't have a root to trace it back to, if that is something that folks over the millennia have associated with a concept of predestination, or is that if you're going to know God, there is no way, or if you know, or even in proximity, that there is no way to escape that knowledge. There's no way to run away from that knowing, or the desire to get a better grasp of that knowing. Is that something that's been associated with that as an experiential aspect?
Oh yeah. Yeah. The Hound of Heaven.
Yeah.
I've heard that great poem.
Right.
And Well, it's so many Christians have turned around and said, you know, I thought I was driving this bus, and, you know, I didn't realize that someone had already laid down the road.
that's very apt. Yeah.
And so, no, that's, you know, and these, I know people like to fight about these kinds of things, but there's it's quite clear that we have to surrender to Christ. Mm. And it's always terrifically mysterious why the work of Christ takes in some people and doesn't in others. And I think all of those experiences and observations were baked into the idea of, you know, what Paul, you know, people point to Calvin, but, you know, Calvin's predestination, he got from Luther and the Roman Catholics. I mean, all of the reformers were christened Roman Catholics. That's just how it was. And predestination wasn't by any means an invention by John Calvin. And I think it tended to be the 17th century, some of those 17th century Reformed writers that began to emphasize it in a peculiar way. So Calvin talked about double predestination, which is in some ways applying rational logic to the Pauline statements about, you know, calling us from the foundations of the earth. So I think people, in terms of our lives, the doctrine of predestination is a teaching that is intended to give us comfort when we recognize just how darn flaky we are. And that there are days when I'm happily a Christian and other days when I just want to throw the whole thing away and I'm just going to go out there and be the naughty dog on a chain.
Right.
The dog that imagines that if he didn't have this chain, he'd be out there catching buses and, doing whatever, but he's on the chain. And so all of those imaginations just stay in his head and he gets fed and, taken care of. So, it's interesting. Lord willing, at some point, it will happen the day of, the day of the consummation, that these longstanding divisions in the church will be healed. But, Calvin was deeply, he begins the Institutes by, with a letter to the Pope. So it's got to say something about his heart. And Protestants are protesting certain things. And Lord willing, there'll be a day when the protests are ended. And I think in many ways, the Roman Catholics and the Protestants are finding ways to appreciate each other and take apart the barricades and begin to embrace each other better.
Part of that. All part of that oatmeal.
Yeah. Yeah. All part of that oatmeal. I love that image. That's great.
That's that. Thank you for that, for the insight. I think it's just one of those, that concept's just another one of those questions where I have my academic disposition and then I have the experiential disposition. Right. So it's trying to not so much reconcile the two, because I know they can be reconciled. It's, how do I reconcile those two organically and then produce an organic and sincere output into how I treat other people and how I treat myself?
Yes.
And that's where all the, to me, any doctrinal or metaphysical or theological course of dialogue, it makes me sad if those conclusions don't trickle down into actions.
And that's right.
How we end up treating one another and our loved ones and strangers among us. And so that's really where it all boils down to. I would say, in my experience, at least, what's in a name, it's all about the actions. And that's where I've seen all that kind of similarity, better and worse.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, when Jesus boils everything down, to the formulation, love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. That's the primary command Jesus tells us to love our neighbor all the way up to and including our enemies.
Right.
And that's a pretty big group. You're hard pressed to find someone who isn't included in that group. And therein lies the challenge of the gospel, in that, in Jesus' own story, his love of his neighbor cost him his life. And none of us get out of this world alive anyway. So why not spend your life on loving your neighbor? It's hard to think of a more beautiful way to spend a life. So
I agree.
Well, thank you, Joseph. This has been tremendous. I will send you this video, and if you give me permission, then I'll share it on the channel, because I think you're too good to keep to myself.
Oh, sure. There's no problems sharing it on the channel. I appreciate you taking the time to speak with me, and thank you again for everything that you're doing with everyone out here, videos or otherwise.
Well, God bless you. And again, I think God's going to do some really cool things with you. So I'm looking forward to that.
Thank you, Paul. You have a great day. God bless you as well.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye.